This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The messaging that we're hearing in East Palestine, like there's nothing to see here, there's no problem, they're not really sick, it's all in their head. We can show you evidence that all of those things were said early on for the Gulf War veterans, even though there's now copious evidence that their exposures were tied to development of these problems, which are now clearly chronic and for many veterans, debilitating health problems.
UC San Diego researcher Dr. Beatrice Golem talks about the actual and potential long-term health effects of the fire and explosive plume at the East Palestine, Ohio, Norfolk Southern train disaster.
I was breaking out with a lot of rashes and I didn't understand it. And Piketon is the largest facility in the world and it's the most contaminated facility in the world. But the state of Ohio signed a consent agreement and we were never even put on the Superfund list.
For over 60 years, tens of thousands of workers and residents have been poisoned by the Portsmouth Nuclear Processing Plant in Piketon, Ohio.
Basically a situation of whether what is deemed not profitable enough will be financed by the taxpayers, but the benefits that can be potentially reaped from it will be directed to private investors and private shareholders.
French railway workers face privatization and the escalating danger of war. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. February 3rd was the one-year anniversary of the Norfolk Southern train derailment and the subsequent toxic explosion and fire in East Palestine, Ohio. Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke spoke to Dr. Beatrice Golem. Dr. Golem heads the Golem Research Group at the School of Medicine at UC San Diego that is currently studying the health effects on volunteers recruited from the region.
Good morning, Dr. Beatrice Golem. Thank you for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
First of all, please tell our Pacific audience something of your background as well as your current fields of research.
Okay. My background is pretty varied. I started out with a degree in physics and graduate physics fellowship offers to Harvard and Caltech. And instead, after working at Jet Propulsion Laboratory as an engineer, did an MD PhD with a PhD in biology and then a postdoctoral fellowship at the Salk Institute. And basically, I was one of the early people in neural networks back in the late 1980s, the stuff that's now very popular with ChatGPT and so forth. Then did medical residency and a year as chief resident, something called a Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholarship with RAND and UCLA. And then I worked at the think tank RAND for some years. And then I've been at UCSD in the School of Medicine for, I guess, since 1998. And I have about 20 years of clinical experience and a lot of years of research experience. And in terms of my current research, it focuses on conditions and exposures with a tie to two fundamental mechanisms of biological injury. One is oxidative stress, which is that type of free radical injury that antioxidants help to protect against. And the other is dysfunction to mitochondria, which are the energy powerhouses of cells. And although there's not a lot of attention, especially to the latter, most things with potential for toxicity actually ultimately end up having their toxicity through these shared mechanisms, along downstream things these shared mechanisms produce, which include impaired blood flow, cell death, autoimmunity, et cetera. And then I have a secondary interest in research methods. But the toxic exposures that we've studied, including Gulf War illness, which we have been instrumental in helping to characterize and find the mechanism for and identify effective treatments for, has related to these shared mechanisms. And sort of an underlying theme in a lot of the conditions that we're interested in are there usually things where there are a group of people suffering who feel that the scientific and medical communities are not helping them and are often dismissing their problem. And that is a common theme with drug and chemical toxicity. And a reason that it commonly occurs is that when these energy powerhouses of cells are disturbed, the typical routine laboratory tests that doctors measure don't show that. It can show up in downstream effects like liver impairment, but the underlying mechanism doesn't show up in tests that typical doctors have access to. So in 2023, like others who heard the news about the derailment and the toxin release in East Palestine, we began to be concerned when the messaging seemed to be that there's no problem, there's nothing to see here, when it was quite clear from the experiences of the residents and the animals in the area that there was a problem. And we'd heard that kind of messaging before for pretty much every one of the conditions that we study, and we recognized that it was not justified to make a claim that there was no problem. The claim was based on reportedly having measured levels of certain chemicals in the environment and saying that they were within allowable standards. But the problem with that is several fold. First off, not every chemical that was released was measured. Second off, the chemicals that were not measured at every time and in every place. Third, that many of the chemicals have very little human safety data, so we don't really know what safe levels are. But most importantly, when chemicals are experienced in combination, that provides very different toxicity. Chemical combinations are known to commonly produce synergistic toxicity, which means more than additive, particularly if there are more than about five chemicals. It is commonly synergistic. And for any N chemicals, where N is the number of chemicals, 2 to the N, meaning 2 times itself, N times combinations are possible. By the time you get to 10 chemicals, that's more than 1,000 possible combinations, virtually none of which will have ever been tested for safety. And because chemicals commonly block the detoxification of other chemicals, compete for detoxification, damage the same targets like the mitochondria, even if every one of them had been in levels that could be known to be safe at every time and in every place, these combinations of chemicals can provide significant toxicity despite fully safe levels of individual agents, had we even known that that were the case. So because of these things, it was clearly not justified to claim that there was not a problem based on the fact that the individual chemicals that had been measured in the times and places they had been measured were reportedly within safe limits. In the face of many people reporting new onset, headaches, shortness of breath, dizziness, neurological problems, cardiovascular problems, gastrointestinal problems, diarrhea and many, skin problems, et cetera.
What chemicals, as far as you know, were on the train? Have you seen a complete inventory? And what do you believe happened after the contractor for the railroad set off this controlled explosion slash burn?
Well, I think there is debate about whether the manifest for the train was complete, but certainly some of the chemicals include vinyl chloride, furans, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, dioxins, benzene reportedly, and when vinyl chloride is burned, it leads to phosgene, which was used as a chemical warfare agent in World War I, and many other, many unknown chemicals are produced. And then the burn also expanded the reach of the chemicals. So, and by the way, I think it was the fire chief that was reportedly given the final determination about whether to undertake the burn, but was given very little time in which to make the decision and reportedly not given full information.
Yes, I believe the head of the National Transport Safety Board recently told a Senate committee that the third option of just waiting was never really presented, and they seemed like they felt the need to act quickly. You mentioned vinyl chloride. What is it? How is it used industrially? And what harm can it do to humans and others, as well as fauna and flora in the environment? And, if you take any of the other chemicals you mentioned, maybe one or two more of those.
Okay.
And
well, vinyl chloride is a colorless gas. It's used in PVC, piping, plumbing, insulation, electrical insulation. It has been listed as a potential terrorist agent. It is known to cause fatty liver, liver angiosarcoma, testicular cancer, a variety of other health problems, and also damages the mechanisms that our lab is focused on, the mitochondria, the energy powerhouses of cells, and causes oxidative stress. and some of the other chemicals like the dioxins and furans and PFAs cause, you know, a number of different types of cancer, like renal cancer, breast cancer, and also cause reproductive harms, sperm quality and number problems with furans, female reproductive problems, and also with the dioxins, female reproductive problems with PFAs and dioxins, you know, alterations in cholesterol profile, you know, blood sugar regulation, heart disease, you know, liver and kidney problems, et cetera. So a wide range of potential problems are caused by these agents. So at toxic levels.
And this comes from a chemical that's basically used to make plastics and plastic piping, that sort of thing, huh?
Well, the vinyl chloride is used for that. The other things have other, you know, various uses, but yeah, generally like furans and food flavorings and chemical synthesis and biofuels and PFAs and nonstick cookware and firefighting foam and stain-resistant fabrics. So a range of different functions for the different chemicals.
Is it known at this point if a chemical like vinyl chloride is spilled? You said it's a gas. Does it stay in nature? Does it stay intact in nature? Does it break down? In what sort of timeline? Kind of like, you know, what we hear about half-lives of radioactive material. Is there a point where these chemicals break down in the environment and are rendered harmless or metabolized somehow by the earth, so to speak?
Yeah, so that's a good question. For a number of these chemicals, the half-lives, you know, can be decades or even centuries. So there is a significant issue with persistence in the environment. Yeah, not necessarily, you know, solely for vinyl chloride, but also the furans and the PFAs, et cetera. Yeah.
On that note, a letter was written by a consortium of residents, workers, environmental groups to the Biden administration just before President Biden's visit to East Palestine last month. It was also sent to the EPA administrator. And a long letter, I wanted to quote one piece of it. Scientifically, no one may ever be able to say with certainty all the chemicals people are exposed to, the concentrations of the chemicals, or how long the exposure lasted. The CDC has stated people were exposed to a broad mixture of toxic chemicals and confirmed that the combined and cumulative effects are unknown. And then the letter draws a parallel to two other events in recent American experience that might parallel this particular incident, which is the first responders, residents, and workers that were exposed to toxic smoke from the destruction of the World Trade Center towers in New York, and also the American soldiers exposed to emissions from burn pit smoke in Iraq and Afghanistan. What is your reaction to this?
I agree with that, and I think I was the first one to introduce the notion that this bore a lot of similarities to the issues associated with burn pits and also Gulf War illness. And many of the respiratory problems that we're seeing in East Palestine are a match to the respiratory problems that something called the PACT Act, service-connected presumptively for military that were exposed to burn pits. What that means to presumptively service-connect something is that if you have the problem and are known to have been exposed to burn pits, then it can be assumed that the burn pits were responsible, and then people can get, military personnel can get appropriate compensation for that. And we're seeing also many parallels to Gulf War illness in terms of the pattern of multiple symptoms traversing multiple different organ systems. A lot of people that are meeting what are called criteria for Gulf War illness among East Palestine residents, and those criteria, the best of them that are the most, quote, specific, meaning that fewer people that did not have that exposure meet these criteria, are the so-called Kansas criteria, and those require symptoms in at least three of six domains that include sleep fatigue, which we're seeing a lot of, neurological, which includes cognitive and mood, which we're seeing a lot of, pain, which we're seeing a lot of muscle pain and headaches, as well as gastrointestinal, and in the Gulf War, diarrhea was the most common problem, and that's what we're seeing again here, respiratory, especially shortness of breath, which we're seeing a lot of here, and also dermatological, and we're seeing lots of skin problems here. So to meet those criteria, those symptoms have to either be more than one within the category or of at least moderate severity. But even with those additional constraints, a lot of those that we've been communicating with in East Palestine look similar. And this makes sense because even though the chemicals are totally different, because these shared mechanisms of mitochondrial injury and oxidative stress and their downstream consequences occur for virtually every chemical that has potential to cause toxicity, including all the ones that I mentioned from East Palestine, it makes sense that at least a subset of the problem would be the same. And for Gulf War illness, it was my group that first hypothesized and then first demonstrated that mitochondrial impairment apparently underlies the illness. The degree of mitochondrial impairment on muscle biopsy is significantly related to the degree of severity of their Gulf War illness on a quantitative scale, whereas things, for example, like inflammation, which are a little bit increased in Gulf War in veterans with Gulf War illness, do not relate at all to the symptoms. So given that that is the mechanism, and given that that injury adds up across multiple different chemicals, and given that that's expected to add across multiple different chemicals here, we think that there is a lot of relevance of the Gulf War experience and a lot of lessons that can be hopefully, you know, translated from the several decades of experience with affected Gulf War veterans to hopefully prevent decades of suffering in those in East Palestine.
I see. Because we mentioned burn pits before. One could assume, you know, things were being burned, but soldiers weren't necessarily standing around inhaling the smoke.
However, they often were.
But there was also in the Gulf War, that is to say, the in Kuwait, the soldiers were vaccinated against potential sarin and anthrax and things like that.
Yeah, they were vaccinated not against sarin, but yes, against anthrax and botulinum. And yes, there were other exposures. The munitions depot demolition at Kamasia, which also led to a plume analogous to, analogous to what was seen with the plume in East Palestine. And again, you know, plume modeling was conducted, and people that were close to that plume showed more problems than people that were further, and people that had longer duration close to the plume had more problems than those who had shorter duration. So those all provide hints about what we should be looking for in East Palestine.
Yeah.
But you're right, there were multiple different exposures there that absolutely included, you know, the depleted uranium and the vaccines and the and pesticides were heavily used and overused, the permethrin impregnated uniforms, so multiple exposures that were different from these multiple exposures that included the inhaled burned products from settings like burn pits and the munitions depot demolitions, but that, as here, also included exposures prior to those burns and distinct from the time of the burning.
Obviously, most of the American soldiers have been pulled out of the area long ago, though it may have been redeployed. But meanwhile, Iraqis and Kuwaitis and others in the area continue to be exposed. Is there any groups similar to yours that are doing research or attempting to mitigate the effects of all these toxins in the environment out in Iraq or the Middle East that you know of?
Well, I don't know of groups attempting to mitigate the chemicals, but there are lots of groups that have done research onto the health effects of Gulf War veterans. Not that many that have done research locally in the area. I think the sole civilian on a fact-finding, fact-disseminating high-level DOD mission to the Middle East in 1997, where we were... everyone else got hazardous duty pay, but we spoke with both officials and on the line, you know, health personnel there, and there just isn't really a tradition of research there. So we don't have good information about what happened to the local individuals, but there are certainly many here that have done research on Gulf War veterans. Every year, the Gulf War veterans had to go back to Congress to appeal for funding for research to be reallocated, and they were successful for many years. And the veteran that I think has been the most effective, just a wonderful, sweet, but definitely affected Gulf War veteran that was very effective just became too sick to do it. And very sadly, for the last couple of years, there have not been reappropriations of money specific for affected Gulf War veterans, which is really a tragedy because, you know, even early on, the estimate was that a third of those deployed, after subtracting the fraction of people, of non-deployed personnel that met similar problems, had these chronic multi-symptom health problems. And the evidence shows that they have not abated over time, and that those veterans are at higher rates of, you know, higher risk of experiencing a number of comorbid, meaning, you know, co-occurring health problems that early on included amyotrophic, you know, lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, this horrible neurodegenerative muscle wasting condition. And that seemed like it was mostly just the first 10 years, but also cognitive loss and hypertension, sleep apnea, coronary artery disease, a range of different conditions that they're at higher risk of because of their Gulf War exposures. And they feel like they're the forgotten veterans. But the messaging that we're hearing in East Palestine, like there's nothing to see here, there's no problem, they're not really sick, it's all in their head. We can show you evidence that all of those things were said early on for the Gulf War veterans, even though there's now copious evidence that their exposures were tied to development of these problems, which are now clearly chronic and for many veterans, debilitating health problems.
What are you calling for in terms of East Palestine? Let's start with that. What are you calling for in terms of a scientifically comprehensive approach to resolving the actual and potential ill effects of this disaster? And what's the minimum time needed to study, to reliably study, resolve, and or mitigate the damage?
I don't know that I'm the person whose opinion anyone would listen to in terms of what I am calling for. But there is no time period that will necessarily capture everything. Some problems are common and occur quickly, and those can be identified quickly, and measures can be taken where available to protect against them and mitigate them, or to surveil for them and the people who will be later to experience them. And that may lead, for example, if it's determined that a cancer type is increased, then if surveillance is then implemented, that may aid people to get early diagnosis. And for some cancers, that may lead to definitive cure, whereas later diagnosis may mean that there isn't really any effective treatment. But some conditions are rarer and or occur later. And that means it takes longer to identify those problems. So really, this is clearly going to be a long-term effort to identify all the problems that might be many of the problems that might be evident at increased levels. You know, there are not as many people here as there were in the East Palestine area as there were deployed to the Gulf, although it depends on how far out you want to look. So for the people the closest in, there may be a bit more challenge in identifying the rarer problems, but some of the problems are pretty common right now. So I think it won't take long to identify certain problems and will certainly take longer for the rarer things like with a longer lead time, like cancer and neurodegenerative conditions. And then additional effort will need to happen to, you know, see whether efforts are effective at reducing symptoms. You know, we did a study in Gulf War veterans with a supplement that supports mitochondria and protects against oxidative stress that did significantly reduce symptoms compared to placebo in a double-blind study, and also significantly improved objectively measured physical function. And we're actually, you know, putting in a proposal right now, a very small dollar amount proposal to a foundation to try to do the same thing in East Palestine, hopefully much earlier on, at a time where we hope it might help to protect against development of the later problems that arise as well.
I guess I was trying to get at, but I should have used the actual word cleanup. As far as you know, what steps have been taken in the region to do any form of cleanup? And if, for example, vinyl chloride in soil ran off through a stream to either Lake Erie or the Ohio River, what sort of dangers would that pose?
Those are really great questions, and my expertise is more on the health side, but I point you to people who are very knowledgeable on those issues. My understanding is that, first off, remediation efforts were initiated, although it took some time, and you can see sort of, you know, strange rainbow colors come up, and there are people that have videos from before the derailment where this did not occur. So claims that this is all legacy chemicals don't seem reasonable. Incidentally, there was a news report that 44,000 aquatic animals had died after the derailment, and people also reported sickness and death of pets, livestock, and wildlife. So this is not just all in those animals' heads, presumably. And apparently some of the chemicals kind of serve as sealants that seal in the other chemicals into the creek beds, so that those chemicals don't necessarily just, you know, run off later. But those issues in terms of the environmental cleanup are not the domains of my particular expertise, and there are other people that are much better qualified to discuss those issues.
So thank you very much, Dr. Gullum, for speaking with me and our Pacifica audience today.
Well, thank you so much for having me and bringing attention to this really, really important issue. I so appreciate it, and I know the residents do as well.
That was Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke speaking with Dr. Beatrice Gullum about the actual and potential long-term effects of the fire and explosion plume at the East Palestine, Ohio, Norfolk Southern train disaster. For more information and or to enroll in their ongoing studies, visit www.golemresearchgroup.org. That's Golem, G-O-L-O-M-B, researchgroup.org.
It was a cold winter night, East Palestine. The moon was bright, stars could be seen. A working class rural East Ohio town had no idea what was about to go down. Then a boom like a bomb shook their homes, flashing and crashing and rattling bones. Rail cars jumbled in giant metal piles, while the flames black smoke could be seen for miles. Three days later, another blast outside bent and burned five cars. Vinyl chloride, dioxin poison in the soil, water and air. Fish and minnows floating dead everywhere. Burning throats caught watery eyes. Vomiting, headaches, kids traumatized. Entire community destabilized. Hardworking people once again victimized. Elected representatives, where are you at? Americans are hurting, why don't you act? So many sick from all this toxic waste. Give these people health care, clean up this place. Declare these cancer alleys mass casualty sites. Time for solidarity, time to stand together and fight. Abandoned by Norfolk Southern, most of the median politicians who govern behind the headlines, just corporate greed. White collar criminals doing dirty deeds. Got money for wars overseas. Bail out the big banks and Wall Street thieves. Meanwhile, Hype Town, Union Town, so many others. No one seems to notice while so many people here suffer.
That was Mike Stout, Stand Up for East Palestine. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Piketon, Ohio has been a nuclear processing site for over 60 years. The Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant, now run by Martin Marietta, has poisoned tens of thousands of workers and residents during that time. Vina Cully was a union electrician at the plant for many years. She now reports that despite the continuing contamination, cancers, and deaths, they want to build more nuclear plants and bring in nuclear waste from throughout the world. She is president of Portsmouth Piketon Residents for Environmental Safety and Security, and co-founder of National Nuclear Workers for Justice. She spoke at the East Palestine, Ohio Worker Environmental and Community Conference on March 23rd.
My name is Vina Colley, and I am president of PRESS, Portsmouth Piketon Residents for Environmental Safety and Security. We have been in existence since 1987. I've been doing this since 1983. I found my first grievance as a worker that I thought there was 30 workers at the plant were being exposed to radiation. I was breaking out with a lot of rashes, and I didn't understand it. And Piketon has 3,800 acres. We have three huge process buildings. It's the largest facility in the world, and it's the most contaminated facility in the world. But the state of Ohio signed a consent agreement, and we were never even put on the Superfund list. And so we just had an epidemiologist that came in, Dr. Joe Mangano, and he found that we have the highest rate of cancer in Pike and Scioto County and the surrounding counties. And so everyone has turned their back on this community, and the reason they have is because they want to bring in those small modular reactors. And transuranic waste means plutonium, americium, neptunium, some of the worst radioactive nuclides that you can even think of wants to be processed there. We have the railroad and truck drivers brought in 24,000 depleted uranium cylinders that are sitting out in the yard. These cylinders give off neutron exposures. And while they were on the train, some of the workers who worked there were my friends. They said they used to sit on those cylinders. And this is even before I knew that they give off neutron exposures. Well, these workers were sitting on the cylinders, and they stood by them all day long in the railroad tracks. And my friends died of cancer. My husband, he passed away with cancer and some blood stuff. My brother-in-law worked at the plant. His leg got contaminated, and he passed away with cancer. My sister-in-law passed with cancer. My nephew, he worked at the plant. He just died of kidney cancer. Piketon is an SEC site, and what that means is we're a spatial exposure cohort, and that means they can't prove our exposures. So they passed a compensation bill in 1999 because we did have plutonium, and they denied it, and I told them in 93. Well, the gas diffusion plants, Piketon, Paducah, and Oak Ridge were in this compensation. Well, Paducah and Oak Ridge was in the compensation bill, and I found out about it. And I had plutonium at Piketon, so we were able to get to our representative, Ted Strickland, at that time. And we got added to the compensation bill by a thread. Well, 2 weeks ago, I find out they have this compensation bill, which is called RECA, and I have a petition for it for people to sign. This bill is a downwinders bill from the uranium miners. And there's a couple ladies there in St. Louis that has the waste facility there that's killing the people that live around there. So they've got this bill open back up again and trying to get their landfill on the RECA. So when I found out, guess what? They added Paducah and Oak Ridge again and left Piketon out of it. So that when I heard it that day, I called my Senator Brown. And I told him what was going on. And they were having a Senate hearing. So as soon as I called his office, him and J.D. Vance went to the Senate hearing. We didn't get on the bill, but we got mentioned. But it passed the Senate. And now this bill is in the House. And we're asking people to call anyone that they know that's a House representative and tell them to put the Portsmouth Gas Diffusion Plant in that bill. I mean, we have the highest rate of cancer in the state of Ohio, and we're 87% national there. When I started working there, I thought it was the safest place in the world because they stressed hard hats and safety glasses. Well, come to find out, I was an electrician, and we were cleaning uranium-contaminated cells with trichloroethylene. And when we got through with this job, we say, where do we dump it? They said down the drains. So we dumped it down the drains. And then when I went to the doctor and I was breaking out of these rashes and he didn't know what was wrong with me, but he said, when you go back to work, make sure you suit up. So I had to suit up and I wore paper coveralls, paper shoes. I wore rubber gloves and Then I would walk in different areas, and these guys says, "What you got all that on for?" And I said, "Well, they told me to keep it no matter where I'm going." And they were getting nervous because I was even going into the lunchroom wearing these protective equipment. Well, that stuff they gave me to wear did not protect anybody. And so after I filed that grievance in 83, they started watching me on the job and making my supervisors take me everywhere that I went. And then my boss, he had to take care of me, and he put me in this golf cart, and we went over in the 333 building. I said, "Where are we going?" He said, "We're going to go over to, there's a radiation alarm going over, and we got to reset the alarm." So when we got in that building, we got halfway down the building, and here comes this gray stuff after us. And he took and put me on this, on the golf cart, and he said, "Let's get out of here." He said, "Job's over." I said, "What was that stuff coming through there?" He never did tell me. So then I got really sick and had to go to a ears, throat, and doctor, and he did a biopsy on my lungs, and he said that I needed to go to an occupational health and safety hospital and be checked. So I went down to Cincinnati, and they did a biopsy, or they did a laryngoscopy on my lungs. And 2 weeks after I left the plant, I had 2.12 fluorides in my urinalysis. So I was in a uranium hexafluoride release at the plant, and they didn't even tell me. So I worked for 5 years, and then I went off, and I was on disability, and they made sure that they took me off workers' comp in 87. And of course, I had lost my pension, but they vested pension at 5 years, Goodyear did. And I lived there all my life, and I didn't even know that we were making weapons for the world. I didn't know. It was called Goodyear Atomic, and I thought they made Goodyear tar and rubber. So I thought all this stuff that was leaking through the process building had something to do with making tars. But their product was leaking through the system. They were getting 290-some-thousand parts per million up here, but I don't know what they got down here because there's other chemicals that was mixing in with it. And they never surveyed the areas that we worked in. They just put us in it. We had a construction crew that worked there. 19 family members that worked for Boone Coleman Construction all died from working at the plant, either from cancer or some type of illnesses. And many of those workers got compensated. They would drive the trucks in, and Goodyear workers would be suited up. Their workers would not be suited up. And so 17 members, and we went to Boone Coleman, we told him, "Boone, your workers are not being suited up. And they're putting this stuff in their trucks, and where they hauled it to, we don't know. We've heard ballparks, the racetrack, different places." So I talked to a few workers that's working there now, and they're doing the same thing. They got truck drivers coming in, taking all this dirt over to the dump. They got 12 cells there now. Our theory was we fought the sales. We didn't want waste sales because we knew once they start that, we would wind up being a dump. Well, that's what they're trying to do now and trying to clean up everybody else's site and not telling these workers that they don't get hazardous pay. And then when we got the compensation bill in 1999, somehow or another, they put a limit. If you worked there from 1952 to 1999, you're automatically added into this bill. Well, after 92, these workers that are doing all this decontamination, and they do open air demo on these buildings, and these workers are not in the compensation bill. Hopefully, the union, I was over at the union hall, and we've been talking about the petition, and they're supposed to be working on one, but if that don't happen, all these workers after 92 will not be compensated for their illnesses. It's such a tragedy. We've been sacrificed. They just don't care. They're trying to make Piketon a nuclear hub, and they'll be shipping all of this nuclear waste, transuranic waste, from all these sites around the world. And not only that, but they're going to be shipping foreign product to Piketon, and we're going to be reprocessing it, and they're trying real hard to put two small modular reactors at Piketon, and they're calling them a powerhouse is what they're calling it, but they're two small modular reactors, and we're going to be reprocessing transuranic waste, and transuranic waste has been reprocessed at Piketon for 70 years, and that has been the biggest secret there. we thought we were producing uranium and uranium hexafluorides and making bomb-grade material, but what they were doing was reprocessing this reactor fuel for 70 years and never told any of us. We weren't suited up to do that.
That was Vina Colley, a former union electrician from the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant in Piketon, Ohio. That was The Pretenders, My City Was Gone. You're listening to Pacificus Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Anne Garrison. The attack on French workers is escalating, with capitalists wanting to privatize France's public train system. At the same time, President Emmanuel Macron is threatening to send French troops to Ukraine. Pacificus' Steve Seltzer spoke with French railway worker and CGT unionist Axel Persson about both issues.
One of the struggles taking place has been in France with the Yellow Vests, and there's a fight there as well against privatization of railways and public services. And joining us is
Axel Persson from the CGT unions and the railway workers of Trappes, which is a city in the southwestern suburbs of Paris, and I'm a locomotive engineer.
The issue of privatization in the United States, public services are being privatized. In France, you have a great rail system, which is also under threat. Why is your union taking up this issue, and what does it mean for railroad workers in France as far as their economic conditions and their social conditions?
The government and also the the big corporations are now actually intent on implementing an agenda that aims to privatize the railway, but not only the railway, in general, all public services. And the reason for that is that they are trying to find new markets in which they can basically expand and garner more profits, even more profits than they are actually doing. So now they're setting up this economical model where they're saying they want to privatize the railway, but what they're in fact going to do, to be very specific, is to make sure that the railway, given the very heavy amount of investments that are needed to make it basically sustainable, it will still be funded by public taxpayers' money, but the operators who will operate the railway will be private and will be subsidized as well. But the public subsidies will be directed to private operators. So it's basically a situation of whether what is deemed not profitable enough will be financed by the taxpayers, but the benefits that can be potentially reaped from it will be directed to private investors and private shareholders. And the consequences for railway workers will, of course, be worse in terms and condition, because they are saying in order to make it even more profitable than it is today, we're going to have to cut down jobs, scale back unprofitable services, raise also passenger fares, and have an all-out offensive on our terms and conditions, on our pensions, and also everything we've basically won for the past decades as workers and organized labor.
And you've had some experience with the RMT, the Railway Workers Union in Britain. They also privatized. What happened after their privatization of the rails?
What happened, and it's very interesting that you mention it, because only 2 weeks ago, we had a delegation of British railway workers from the RMT and also from Sweden, from the SECO trade union, who visited our workplaces and met rank and file workers to explain firsthand the consequences of privatization, which are the first and most immediate one is that the investments, the long-term investments for the maintenance of the network were no longer being made by these private investors because they deemed it not profitable enough. They just wanted the short-term profits, which has led to massive defaults, massive failures, and accidents. And the British railway workers are currently alerting the general public that there is a multiplication of serious failures all across the network, including derailments, including track breaks, tracks that are literally collapsing because of lack of maintenance, which will lead to a catastrophe. And they are saying that now is not only, we're no longer asking the question, will there be a catastrophe? It's just a matter of time before it happens. And the other consequence, of course, is that the terms and conditions of the railway workers since privatizations have been shoved down the gutter, basically. But that doesn't mean that they have stood idly by. They've also led massive strikes. They are leading currently a campaign for the bringing back the rail into public ownership, and they are also organizing massive series of strikes despite draconian anti-strike laws that are in place, but that have managed to defeat in order to force the train operating companies and the company that manages the network to force through real-term wage increases. And also they have managed to successfully defend the jobs, for example, at the station offices that they plan to close down. So they have also shared experiences of successful struggles, and that is also something that we are inspiring ourselves from.
And how are the French workers, and particularly railway workers, organized in a way that you can fight to defend yourself? Because bureaucratization, corporatization of unions, business unions, make it very difficult for workers to organize political campaigns. In fact, there's no national campaign in the United States against privatization, yet it seems like the French are actually taking that up.
Yes, of course, like in all countries, like in all labor movements, we have our problems. We do sometimes have issues, of course, with bureaucrats, with some unions that are bureaucratized, and we have our issues as well, of course. But the good thing is that given the legacy of the French workers' movement, especially in the railway and some other industries, we have strong unions, even if though they're weaker than they were, for example, 20 or 30 years ago. But we still have functioning unions in the workplace that can make sovereign decisions and that are organized nationally in a federation where we can launch united and unified campaign all across the territory, which means that when we call for a national strike and that this stems from the workforces, this stems from the work floor.
Actually have votes and discussions in the workplace and make decisions locally. How is that possible?
Exactly. That's where I wanted to come to, is that when we go on strike, we make sure that all decisions pertaining to the organization of the strike, be it how we organize the picket line, how we use the strike funds, the content even of the leaflets, everything is discussed in a general assembly that is held daily, except during weekends, because then we need to rest, because striking can be really tiring. And we vote on everything. And the most important decision on whether to continue or or stop the strike is taken by a vote in all depots at 10 a.m. every morning when we are on strike. All across the country, there will be a general assembly where we will ask the question, does the strike continue or not? Of course, as a union, we will have a position where we will suggest it to the workers, but in the end, it's the workers and the rank and file that will decide on whether we continue the strike or not. And for example, when we have negotiations with the company, the government, whatever, the results of the negotiations are basically being reported back to all the general assemblies, who will then decide, is this good enough or not good enough for us? That's the most important aspect, is that the rank and file must decide for the conduct of the strike, because they are the ones striking, so only they must make the decisions.
Ed, are you shocked about the decline of both of the infrastructure of the United States, collapsing infrastructure, and also the railroad derailments once every couple of days, plus even Boeing, the lack of safety on Boeing? Is this a surprise or shock to you?
It's not a surprise. It's still a shock because of the consequences, of course, because we're talking about people's lives. Of course, not only those working on the railroads, because we have, you see people working on the railroad who are exposed to severe danger, but also for the passengers, also the accidents like the one in Lake Megantic, I forgot the name of it, and East Palestine. Those are like severe accidents that are directly linked to failures of the Class 1 railroads. And those who have paid the consequences are, of course, the railway workers and the communities who have suffered from these massive accidents. And it all boils down to the greed of those who own the railroad, because these accidents are not a fatality. They could have been avoided with proper maintenance procedures and proper staffing. These accidents can't...
It's not rocket science.
Exactly. Yeah. It is a science, but it's not something unattainable. We know how to not make these accidents happen. And what is worrying is that even though we're not at that stage in France, we know that the same causes will lead to the same consequences. And we can already see in France, despite the fact that we have a railway that is, of course, it's not comparable to the state of the US railway, which is really, really rock bottom, at the lowest it can get. But we can see that the same causes are going to lead to the same consequences. And we are already seeing in the French railway, because of the fact that our companies, the company is now trying to basically implement a management style that is similar to one in the US or to Great Britain, we are starting to see that these consequences are starting to appear in the French network, and we want to halt that because we know what it's going to lead to. So that's also part of the campaign to raise public awareness around the risk. It's not only about our terms and conditions, which is of course very important. We will never excuse ourselves. We're not ashamed of defending our terms and conditions, but it's not only about that. It's also about a public safety issue. It's a public health issue also.
And the governments of the United States, they're going to give maybe $92 billion more for war to Israel, to Ukraine, to Taiwan. Macron, your president, has said that he may send troops to Ukraine. It seems like there's unlimited resources, billions of dollars for war. What is your union, and what do working people in France think about these issues?
We as a union who organize the working class, who organize regular working people, we are saying that this war is of no interest to working people, because these are wars that are being fought by competing imperialist powers over issues such as control over natural resources, geopolitical influence, basically interests that are not ours, but yet they are going to ask us not only to fund it through our tax money, but also at the end of the day, if they deem it necessary, they're going to ask working class people to fight that war on the ground, boots on the ground, and while they are being kept safely in their bunkers far away from the front lines. So we are saying these type of wars, they are not our wars, and we're going to do everything in power by any means necessary to halt that dynamic. And we're going to, of course, campaign against this this craziness, this foolishness, because this is going to lead to a widespread massacre in which working people from all over the world have nothing to gain. And there used to be a saying in the European Socialist Movement already during at the eve of the First World War, where Rosa Luxemburg, for example, said that the options that the working class will be faced with will be either barbarism or socialism. And I think that is actually something that is still very actual today. And we can see that where we're headed, we are still faced with the same two options, barbarism or a better future. And it's up to us to prevent that barbarism from happening.
That was French CGT railway worker and unionist Axel Persson speaking to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Seltzer, Thomas O'Rourke, and Polina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.